honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, leading you into the 75th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy with the recollections of four different men who jumped behind enemy lines on June 6, 1944. Tom Rice is 97 now. This will be the seventh year in a row that he will perform a tandem skydive as a tribute to his fellow D-Day paratroopers. This year, he'll do it out of a C-47, and he'll do it in France, just like he did as a 22-year-old.
On the evening of June 5, we met early evening, and we went to our aircraft. We had six parapacks slung underneath the aircraft. Each one weighed 300 pounds and had all of our equipment, probably machine gun, tripod, and ammunition, and maybe a bundle full of K rations or TNT or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Six parapacks underneath. Each one weighed 300 pounds. We rolled those, packed them, and rolled them, and attached them to the aircraft, and then practiced a drop so that things going to work.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Is that just a lever that releases them or something?
Yeah, number two man behind, I jumped number one. Mm-hmm. Number two man had a switch. That would drop the six parapacks simultaneously. If that failed, number three man had a lever, and he would pull that lever, mechanical operation there. That would drop the six parapacks. So we had double check on that.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped number one, last one to get in the plane, so I was number one seat there. It's the shape of an arrow, and we were parked on the side, what do we call part of that arrow. Each plane would swing down and then take off. If any plane had a problem, there would be a mess.
Yeah.
On one of the planes taking off, there was a fella in the plane who fired his rifle into his foot. Evidently, he freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
The officer went over and grabbed him, lifted him up, banged him up against the bulkhead of the aircraft, just as it was moving down the runway, not going very fast, took him to the door and threw him out.
Wow.
Then an inquiry occurred later after we came back from Normandy and completely exonerated the officer. That's what he should have done. We never knew who this fellow was. That was kept quiet.
Wow.
We know who the officer was.
Right.
That was
right.
Good. But anyway, here we are on the takeoff field. Planes were taking off, one right after another, one every 10 seconds. I mean, when that plane revved up, it sounded like every rivet was going to come apart. You know, I mean, there was noise. I went forward, sat down on the lower deck, and leaned against the cockpit door and told the pilot that if there's any problem that relates to us, let me know. I'll fall back and wake up. So I stayed in that position most of the time until the officer in charge, Lieutenant Jansen, told me to get up there to number one. You know, above the door, there's three lights.
Mm-hmm.
There's a red, a white, and a green one. The Pathfinders are already in. Some of them missed the drop zone. Some of them didn't. Some of them were spread so far apart that it's unbelievable. We got the worst drop in the entire 13,200. When we took off at 10:41, English double summertime, we flew at 5,000 feet. We assembled in groups of 45 each. That was called a section.
Mm-hmm.
I was in section 14, third from the lead plane on the right. I'm jumping number one. We dropped down to 1,500 feet after the section had organized itself. Now, we were about 100 feet wingtip to wingtip.
Mm-hmm.
Real close, tight formation. We flew past Jersey and Guernsey Island. In the water was a small submarine that emitted a signal to show that we were on the right track for the pilots to follow. And then we got to another signal, and at that point we turned left. Now, if you can visualize the Cottonton Peninsula on the left and the Brittany Peninsula on the right. This was a neat scheme because the Germans didn't know whether we're going to go right or we're going to go left.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned left. I'm at the door getting things organized and following instructions. I looked out and I saw low tide. I saw the community of Brownsville, and I could see the pattern of rivers that ran into the channel there. White light is on. Red and green are off.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit Brownsville, the red light goes on, means we got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stand up and hook up. We're all standing up. We're holding on to the steel cable that runs, 3/8 inch steel cable that runs right through the center. Mm-hmm. We have to hook up our webbing to that mm-hmm. with an anchor line snap fastener and in our left hand and make sure it faces the right way. Got it faced the wrong way, could be in trouble. So stand up and hook up. It was verbal signals and mechanical signals so that everybody understood. A red light was on. We were checking. We ran into fog. Now, we're less than 100 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The lead plane had a blue light on the dome, and it was at a little lower altitude. The others were staggered up a little bit so the pilots could see the blue light. When that blue light goes on, that means that lead plane got the signal from the pathfinders, and they crossed the T, and they snapped on the green light. So we jump at that point. Ran into fog. I was looking out the door, and I could see just almost a rectangular area that was just filled with tracers. There were yellow, there were red, there were green, and white. It looked like the 4th of July, you know. Nothing bursting like that, but tracers coming up. We were heading into that.
Oh, this is ahead of you. You can tell yeah. that this
is what we're going to have to go through.
The artillery fire is already happening.
It's already happening. We're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. So they avoided it, and I think the pilot may have panicked a little here because there was an investigation afterwards. We swung off to the right. All of Company C swung off to the right because we had 9 planes.
Mm-hmm.
Our company commander ended 20 miles from our drop zone. We didn't get together for a whole week. We were spread all over the place. We were originally, as I understood it, to jump on drop zone B. They found out that drop zone B was underwater. So it was fortunate that when they broke the pattern of flight, we were over the edge of D, and I went out over the edge of D. The only thing that bothered me is that I was going to get castrated because the machine gun bullets were on the left wing, and they might come through the floor of the plane. You know.
Mm. So as you're jumping, your plane's getting hit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You could hear it on the wing.
Wow.
And now our gas tanks are not self-sealing. And the pilot is yawing and pitching. We're going up and down to avoid penetration with shells, you know,
mm-hmm.
and bullets, whatnot. Up and down. The guys were wobbling. The green light goes on. I jump. And just as I did, number one and number two men pull the switches. The plane goes up because the load was dropped.
Right.
And I went out the door at the same time. And when I turned, the prop blast, we were going 165 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
We got a jump at 95 to 100. The jump master, lieutenant, called the pilot and said, slow this thing down. We can't jump. Now, the pilot's yawing and pitching, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
He ignored it. So when I went out, we were yawing and pitching, and the plane went up 50 feet. The pair packs dropped. The prop blast hit me and threw me up against the side of the aircraft.
Wow.
My left arm got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. So I swung out, my helmet came down over my face, my reserve parachute was forced up to my face because the musette bag was underneath. So I didn't know what the dickens was going on. 2.8 seconds transpired, nothing should have opened by that time. So I swung in and hit the aircraft side again, swung out, got the helmet up, and I saw the parapax cover of the parachute flapping under the rudder of the airplane. So number two and number three man got loose, got out.
Mm-hmm.
So when I swung back in, I turned a little bit and I got free.
I can't imagine what that feels like. You talk about disaster. Here, this is your moment,
yeah.
Your first experience in the war, really, in what's going to be a combat situation. You almost didn't get away from the plane.
Get away from it, yeah.
And you would have died.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't free yourself, probably.
I had a Hamilton wristwatch, a gold Hamilton wristwatch. It cost me $150, and that was stripped right off of my arm. My arm was black and blue from the armpit down to the wrist.
Ooh.
And I didn't know it until 3 weeks later and taking some clothes off. We didn't take any clothes off, you know. I have to guess at the altitude. I'll make a conservative guess. I jumped from 500 feet to 400 feet, 750.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the ground pronto.
That must have been a pretty rough landing.
Oh, yeah. It was a hard landing. So,
what'd you come down in? What kind of terrain?
It was grassy area that was more pasture than anything, and then a small ditch that was, about 6 feet deep, full of water, smelly, dirty water. And so here I am on my back. I can't get my harness off because the musette bag, the reserve parachute, a May West, and a quick release. Now, the quick release had a toadstool type thing on it, and when you arm it, a red dot shows, and then you hit it like that, and it springs out. You probably know about that thing.
Right.
Okay, whatever they want to call it. I couldn't get at that thing. I had a double zipper up here under my chin with a switchblade knife, so I unzipped that, and incidentally, I had the cricket under there. You know about the cricket?
Tell everybody about the cricket.
Yeah, okay, so just mention that so you're on track with me.
The cricket's going to come in handy later.
Yeah, maybe.
In theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
In theory, yeah.
Yeah.
So the cricket and the jump knife are in the same pocket, right? Double zipper right under my chin.
Uh-huh.
So I unzipped that. The cricket fell out. I lost it and didn't know it. I got the double-bladed knife out and start cutting the risers. I got halfway through one riser, and number two and three man came up. They had the mortar. Evidently, they had found one of the bundles and got the mortar. So that means time has gone by here for a little bit. So we crossed the canal, and Frank Ficarota, one of the guys on the carrying the mortar parts, went into the canal. We had to dig him out. He came out smelling like you can't believe, yelling and screaming. This is supposed to be a quiet situation, you know.
So, yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's the middle of the night. Dark. You're supposed to be surprising the enemy.
So we got him quiet, and we worked our way over to a decomposed granite road. I heard some footsteps maybe 150 yards away on decomposed granite. So I got him quiet, did the click. One of the guys did the click, because mine was lost. And they got a click back.
And that's what, when you mentioned the cricket earlier, some people are saying, what, he's carrying little bugs around? No, this was a device that would allow you to communicate with others without drawing too much attention.
That's right, and no identification, you see.
What does it sound like?
Click, click, mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. You just didn't hold one click, you're going click, click.
Right.
And the answer would be double click, 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 click. Uh-huh. Then we would work toward each other, clicking continually.
Right.
We got within safe distance. Then we'd use the password. So let's say you're airborne and you're one of my friends, and we clicked successfully. I'm not sure about you. It could be a German enemy that has one of these things.
Yeah.
So I go with the password, flash.
Gordon.
You would then recognize that flash. Uh-huh. Possibly I'm an American.
Right.
I don't know still about you. You come back with thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Then that puts me at ease that you possibly are an American. Now, to cinch it from flash, thunder, then I'd say welcome. And a German trying to pronounce welcome, the W is a V, welcome, you see. You'd pick that up real quick. Mm-hmm. Then we'd meet, get up and hug each other and find out who we are, and he's probably somebody from the 82nd Airborne.
And you're doing all this, which you've never done before, not in this situation, in the dark, with an arm that almost got ripped off, a back that's probably all bruised up from the impact.
Yeah.
Were you feeling pain? Were you even conscious of that?
No. I mean, our focus was to do what we're supposed to do and get organized and group.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got objectives.
And did you have any idea where you were?
No. These guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road. And we clicked them and met them. And we stood up and kind of conversed. And one of them came to me and said, I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent.
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty. And if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, I got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. I said, okay, give it to me. Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and they looked like I didn't recognize. Here's one of the things we tried to learn is the profile if we saw these guys at night. Mm-hmm. And our maneuvers and their voice. I wasn't sure. There was a number of them, and I wasn't sure about their voices or their profiles. But I felt that things were friendly enough. I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even mm-hmm. though I may not have been. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
But your leadership qualities.
There you go.
Rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had to.
Yeah. So. Right, sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, wait, if that guy, that's his problem, that's not your problem.
So we broke up into groups and went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, nothing's happening here, but I saw a house on the side of the road about 50 yards back and said, we got to investigate this. So I set about five of them around to the back of the house. And Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know. He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be. You wouldn't believe this. In a long, white nightgown from shoulder to floor. Mm-hmm. With a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. And the reason being, I suddenly recognized that's the Christmas Carol play, uh-huh. Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
I saw that. And it looked like...
It looked like Scrooge.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So he didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. 3 or 4 of the guys followed behind me, and I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out from another door dressed the same way. Uh-huh. That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out and he got 6 rounds of ammunition. He gave us 4 and he kept 2. And so we left right away, assured him we're not going to do anything. Went out on the road again with 3 of us, walking in the ditch real low, and a lieutenant ahead of me yelled, "Hey, Sergeant, come here." Now, he was standing at a large gate where cattle would go enter and come out. And it was a pasture field in there. He was standing there and said, "Sergeant, I want you to walk around this field on the edge. I'm going to stay right here and wait." He had a carbine rifle, a short one, with a metal stock on it. This guy was bound to, had it in his mind, he's going to get a sniper. I'm a bait.
Thanks a lot.
I knew it was exactly what he's doing, so I walked that perimeter, 600 and some yards, and I had my trigger finger ready to go, and I had that submachine gun up. You know, looking into the trees, mm-hmm. I got back to the point where he set me off. He was gone. I learned a couple things. Never arrive at your point of departure as a final destination because they could have seen it, uh-huh. could have watched me. 50-some years later, New York staff writer called, wanting to come out and interview me.
Uh-huh.
He took 100 pictures of me for all what reason, I don't know. Then he started asking questions. And on the question period, he asked me to explain some heroism. I said they were all heroes. And then it hit me. I'll explain what happened right there. And I told him what happened, what that lieutenant did. I said, this is a situation of cowardice. They printed that story. They printed my picture with it. And I hope that son of a gun saw it.
If he made it through the war.
If he made it, yeah, if he made it. I figured this guy's going to get somebody killed. But so we wandered around there out in fields, and a horse was had been hit with shrapnel. A medic I had with me, Robert Schill, he patched him up with sulfadiazone, and we used the horse as a protection to get to some other point. Went into a house, searching the houses, and I crossed a window, and I had a rifle shot come through for the sniper. It hit just in front of me and caught me in the leg. It was a hard, like I was hit like a baseball bat almost, you know, so mm-hmm. I could pull the pant leg up and pulled it out and put it in my pocket. I never knew what happened to it after that.
So this is your first day.
Yeah.
And you're already hit.
First day. This is June 6th.
Mm-hmm. And you've already got a wound in your leg.
Yeah, I got a wound that I didn't pay too much attention to. It didn't bother me that much, crying out loud. I'm not going to medic and say, give me a Purple Heart or make a record of this baloney. We were in the most exclusive fraternity that occupies space on the face of the earth. That is a foot soldier and the airborne on patrol in enemy territory. That is a fraternity. Mm-hmm. There's not many guys in that.
And very few of Tom Rice's vintage. Keep your eyes out for that amazing 97-year-old jumping again in France on the 75th anniversary. That's our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.